untold stories from the Apollo program, and a look ahead at some upcoming NASA science missions. You're listening to Are We There Yet?, the radio show exploring space exploration. Hi, I'm Brendan Byrne. When we think about the first moon landing, we often think about Buzz Aldrin and Neil Armstrong hobbling across the moon and placing the American flag in lunar soil for the first time. But who are the people behind the scenes that helped them get there? We'll speak with Joanne Higgins about the podcast The Other Moonshot that explores the stories of three black engineers and their contributions and struggles during the Apollo program. Then, three missions are launching this year that will help us understand our universe like never before. From studying our sun to mapping millions of galaxies, NASA is ready to explore the solar system and beyond. We'll speak with NASA's Denton Gibson about these launches, the mission's objectives, and what it takes to find rockets to bring these things into space. That's ahead on Are We There Yet? During the space race of the 1960s, all hands were on deck as NASA worked to send astronauts to the moon for the first time. Nearly 500,000 people were employed, with jobs as scientists, engineers, researchers, and more. When Neil Armstrong and Buzz Aldrin did walk on the moon for the first time in 1969, it changed human space exploration forever. But who were the people behind the scenes that made it all possible? In her new podcast, The Other Moonshot, Joanne Higgins explores the untold stories of three black engineers who contributed to the program, including their passions, struggles, and the discrimination they faced. For Black History Month, she spoke with our producer, Marion Summerall, about these men and why she decided to tell their stories in the first place.
Joanne, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
I'm really excited to talk about this podcast. You hosted the podcast called The Other Moonshot, but it all began because of your godfather, and he told you some really interesting stories growing up, right?
I was visiting my godfather in the hospital, and a colleague of his that he had worked with came to visit, and they started talking about the Apollo program. And I hadn't really recalled him specifically telling me, as I was growing up, about the Apollo program. He talked about aerospace in a very general way. But this day, they were just talking about it like two old buddies. And I thought, wow, I had no idea. And so I recorded them right there in the hospital room. And then I listened to it a couple of days later, and I thought, wow, I didn't really learn about this part of the aerospace program in school. And I certainly didn't realize that my godfather actually had anything to do with going to the moon. So I thought, well, you know, if I don't know, maybe other people don't as well. And I thought, this might make a wonderful podcast.
And your podcast is a four-part series that highlights these men that contributed to the Apollo program. Tell me a little bit about these men.
Well, my godfather, Charlie Cheatham, is the one who inspired me. He is now 95 years old, and he worked on the Apollo program. But the thing that was really fascinating about him for me is that he was one of the first black engineers hired by North American Aviation at the time. And then he went on to work as an engineer when they started the Apollo program. What he worked on was configuration management, which is the setup we use for car parts, actually. Every part that goes on a car has like a serial number, and they really needed to develop this type of system with regard to the spacecraft, because when it often went up in the very beginning through research and development, it didn't come back down or something happened. And so the way they would identify and troubleshoot and track things down was through configuration management. Nate Levert, who was also an engineer, who is featured on the podcast, worked on rocket propulsion. And it was just amazing the things that he was able to do, because when North American got the contract to build the Apollo, they didn't get any information. They got this piece of paper that said, get us as close to the vicinity of the moon as you can. There wasn't even this idea of landing. Then there was Shelby Jacobs. He was in charge of a lot of different things, but what he is the most known for is mounting a camera and getting photos of the curvature of Earth. One of the first photos that we got, where we actually saw, the Earth isn't flat. It's really round.
You said you realized not only your godfather's contributions, but those of other Black engineers that have been overlooked and maybe left out in these topics when we talk about Apollo history. This was during a time where a lot of other things were going on, right? I'm sure they faced some struggles in their career, right?
Yes. Well, coincidentally, this race to space was also very much a race about race, because it was right in the midst of the civil rights race that was going on all over the country, and specifically in Los Angeles at the time. So them working on the Apollo program, while just so exciting for them to be doing something so profound, the things they had to deal with on a day-to-day basis because of being men of color was not good for them. They faced a lot of discrimination. Their work was questioned. They did not get paid the same as their white colleagues. They had dossiers kept on them secretly. They couldn't all gather at the water cooler. They have this saying that you couldn't have more than three Black men at the water cooler at one time. So there were just a lot of really inhospitable things that they had to deal with in this very exciting, creative, innovative environment. The thing I also was fascinated by with regard to them was that because they're all different, the thing they really have in common is they were all Black men and they were all Black engineers. But the way they dealt with the discrimination was different. They all developed very different coping mechanisms to deal with it. And I found that probably one of the most fascinating aspects of their stories.
What was it like to be interviewing these men and telling their stories and kind of highlighting this and highlighting their contributions?
I had to convince at least two of them to tell their story. When I originally approached them, the response was, oh, that happened so long ago. No one's interested in hearing anything about what I did. So it took me a while to convince two of them to really tell me. Then when I got them to start talking about it, it was also very interesting because these men are engineers, and I'm convinced engineers think differently than some of us. You know, they just think about things differently, because in the beginning, trying to get them to talk about how they felt about some of the things that were happening seemed to be very challenging. But after several interviews, then they finally started talking about how these circumstances made them feel. And then I started hearing from their family members, who sometimes would sit in on the interviews, that these men had never, ever told them any of this information. That they went to work, they came home, but they did not share like any of these problems that they had in the workplace. Our fear of quitting because the treatment was so bad. It was really kind of cathartic for me, and as I came to understand, for them as well.
In your opinion, what persevered them to keep going, to not quit?
Their passion. They all have that in common, and they had different passions personally, but their combined passion was they all wanted to be involved in something creative that had to do with space or aerospace or planes. My godfather actually wanted to be an architect. That didn't work out when he was young and went to school. It was suggested to him that he not pursue architecture because as a man of color, he wouldn't be able to travel and see different architectures in the world. So he went into the service and became interested in airplanes. That carried him, that passion carried him. Nate, from the time he was like 8 years old, he used to go to an airport close by where he lived and watch the planes take off. So he became fascinated with air travel. Shelby also, he went to school. He knew he wanted to be an engineer, but also was told when he was in school that he wouldn't be able to become an engineer because Black men didn't become engineers, but he had this passion for it. And so they all really defied what they were told and loved, just really loved their jobs. I mean, I call them my own personal superheroes because they were heroic. And one of the reasons we call it the other moonshot is because what they had to deal with was the other part of the moonshot experience. And I don't think these men had the luxury of not choosing, you know, or of caving. And all of these men were born during the Jim Crow period. So they understood prejudice and restrictions. So it's almost like that oppression just increased their drive and their dreams.
Now that the series is out, I'm sure you've been able to touch base with them and connect with them. Tell me a little bit about their reactions of seeing their stories published so the world can hear their work and their legacy. What was their reaction?
We had a listening session for them. And Nate, who gave me the most difficulty in getting him on board, I had to call him constantly. And actually, Shelby is the one who really convinced him to share his story with me. So at the listening session, after it was over, I walked over to him. And I said, so Nate, you still think no one's interested in your story? Yeah. And he was tearful. And he's like, I was wrong. And that was just, it just made me feel so incredible and so grateful for them. Because I think it really put them in touch with the fact that they did do something fabulous and something they loved.
And Joanne, you described them as your personal heroes, right? With working on this podcast, you touched on that it was emotional, that it was a very rewarding experience. What's the overall message you want listeners to take away from your work and hearing the stories of these men?
That our stories and our history often collide, you know, in very positive ways. And when they do, they can just explode into like something incredible for all of us to absorb and take in and learn from. I learned so much and I'm still learning even as this process goes on. And these men learned that they're kind of special. I think for the takeaway is, one, there are so many stories around us, and if we look and listen, we'll find them. And some of them are worth telling.
Joanne, thank you so much for joining us. We've been speaking with Joanne Higgins. She's the host of the Other Moonshot podcast. Joanne, thank you so much for joining us.
Well, thank you.
The Other Moonshot podcast can be found on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you stream podcasts, just like this one. Still to come, how do you map millions of galaxies? With SphereX, of course.
It's going to be really looking at the different light spectrums of the galaxy and collecting a lot of data on the origins of the universe.
How one space observatory is scanning the skies and how it's going to get there. That's ahead on Are We There Yet? You're listening to Are We There Yet? I'm Brendan Byrne. Are we about to get clobbered by an asteroid? While its chances of impact are slim, the asteroid 2024 YR4 is about the size of a football field, and if it did hit, the damage could be catastrophic. Hear more about the asteroid, its probability of hitting Earth, and how we track these things in the first place. That's next week on Are We There Yet? But for now, we're talking about space observatory satellites and other missions heading into orbit. From observing over 450 million galaxies to studying Earth's weather from space, NASA has several missions launching this year that will study our universe and solar system like never before. The missions are SphereX, IMAP, and Sentinel 6B. But to get these missions off the ground, prep is key. Here to talk more about these missions and how he helps get them into space is Denton Gibson. He's the launch director at NASA's Launch Services Program at the agency's Kennedy Space Center right here in Florida. Denton, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks for talking to you. It's a very busy year for you as a launch director with some pretty big missions. We're going to talk about a few of them here. First, let's talk about SphereX, which is launching soon. First of all, am I saying that acronym correctly?
Yes, SphereX is the way we pronounce that acronym.
Gotcha. So tell me about this mission.
Yeah, that's funny. The acronym, the reason why we use the acronym, because the actual title of the mission is pretty long. It's the Spectrophotometer for the History of the Universe, Epoch of Reionization and Ice Explorers.
SphereX is much better for me. Yes. Thank you.
SphereX, that's why everybody just goes by that. Yeah. And basically what this mission is doing, it's going to be observing the galaxy and collecting data of over 450 million galaxies, along with more than 100 million stars in the Milky Way. And it's going to be really looking at the different light spectrums of the galaxy and collecting a lot of data on the origins of the universe. So that's one of the things it's going to be doing. When we launched that one, we actually launched it along with a secondary spacecraft called Punch. And what Punch is going to be doing, so actually four satellites about suitcase size that will work together to produce images of the inner solar system around the clock. And it's going to be looking at the sun's corona and the heliosphere, which is that magnetic bubble around the Earth. So very cool satellites we have. One of them is really looking at the galaxy. Another one is focusing more on the sun and our solar system and the corona effects coming from the sun. So it's two very, very good missions that we'll be launching out of Vandenberg Space Force Base in California on the 27th of February.
Denton, was that by design that SphereX and Punch would be flying together? Or did it just so happen that one payload was going to a place where the other one could hitch a ride to?
One of the big things the Launch Services Program does is we find rides for our NASA spacecraft. We try to find the appropriate rocket who has the capabilities of delivering the spacecraft safely to a particular place on orbit. Particularly for SphereX, the rocket that we found for it, which was the Falcon 9, and we of course went through a competitive procurement process, had excess capability that would enable a secondary spacecraft, like the four Punch spacecrafts that we have. And we on our team work diligently to make sure that the SphereX spacecraft can fly safely on the Falcon 9 and work through all that integration, as well as being able to incorporate the four secondary Punch spacecraft. So in essence, yeah, it's a little bit of both. One, that SphereX is going to a particular location in space and had the excess capability, but we also work hard to make sure that we can use that excess performance on the Falcon 9 to launch smaller secondary payloads.
Not to simplify the work that you do, but you're essentially a solar system travel agent, it seems.
Yeah, that is part of it, yes. But not only that we're a travel agent, we ensure that their ride is safe and successful.
So SphereX is heading to a low Earth sun synchronous orbit. Tell me a bit about what job the Falcon 9 rocket has to do to make sure that this satellite gets to where it needs to be so that it can take these images that we can see the history of the universe.
So the first major thing the Falcon 9 does is you got to make sure we have to fight gravity, right? And well, that's one of the hardest parts of the job is getting up out of the Earth atmosphere. Falcon 9 has the performance to do it. And it that was the first major thing it does. It gets it up out of the Earth's atmosphere. And as the Falcon is flying through the atmosphere, one of the things it has to do is really protect the spacecraft. So inside of the payload fairing, it really protects it from those from the atmosphere as it's traveling to upwards of 17,000 miles an hour. It's protected from those aerodynamic forces as it's going through the atmosphere. In addition to that, we also has to keep it within a particular thermal range in terms of the heating as you're flying through the atmosphere and keep it within a certain temperature range. And a rocket flight can be a little rough sometimes. So that's the other thing the Falcon 9 has done a good job of, keeping the environments for which the spacecraft is, it's need to be able to survive, the Falcon 9 has the capability of doing that. And that's one thing we make sure that it does. But once it gets up out of the atmosphere, it has to deliver it in a very precise orbit. And particularly for this Fear-X spacecraft, it doesn't have its own propulsion system like most spacecraft does. So we had to make sure that design, we had to find a rocket that is capable of delivering it in a very precise orbit. And we had to design a trajectory so to make sure that Sphere-X gets exactly where it needs to be, because it doesn't have its own propulsion system. So we, part of our job, was we ensuring that the flight trajectory is designed correctly and that the Falcon 9 also has the capability and ensure that it does that well enough to get Sphere-X exactly where it needs to be.
Denton, I remember speaking to some of your colleagues at LSP about those trajectories, and especially with this one not having any propulsion, it's got to be in this pinpoint accuracy there. Do you have multiple trajectories mapped out for multiple launch times should something get delayed out at Vandenberg Air Force Base?
Yes, absolutely. So that's one of the things our team does, is we look at all possible scenarios and ensure that we are capable of doing this mission if we were to have a delay for any reason. And so our team would go and look at, okay, for over the next month, what launch opportunities can we possibly do, and making sure that we hit that, we have a good flight solution that could allow us to launch just about any day of the month.
Fascinating stuff and very intricate math. So thank you for doing it.
Oh, absolutely.
All right, let's come back to my side of the country at Cape Canaveral. IMAP, the Interstellar Mapping and Acceleration Probe, that is launching as well. What's exciting about this mission?
So this one's another exciting one. As you said, it's going to do that interstellar mapping, and it's looking another one that's kind of looking at that heliosphere, right? So we just talked about Punch, what their Punch is doing, and now IMAP is really more or less looking at that magnetic bubble around Earth, that how we are protected from those solar winds and that space weather that the Earth encounters all the time. I mean, if you were around last year and we had that significant solar event where we were seeing the aurora just about everywhere on the planet, this is kind of things that IMAP will be looking at, is that bubble that is protecting us from a lot of the solar winds, et cetera. So that's definitely something that is interesting to me. And this is another one where we're going to have a secondary on, a very good secondary on top of that, is our space weather follow-on mission, which is a very good NOAA satellite that's going to be launching as a secondary along with IMAP. Is basically a NOAA satellite that'll be looking particularly at space weather. And I know every time I say space weather, some people think, oh, there's weather in space? Yes, there absolutely is weather in space. I know you're probably well aware of that, but the average person typically is shocked when I tell them we do have weather in space.
Denton, what else is launching with IMAP? Is there also a secondary payload, much like Sphere-X?
Yes, IMAP has two secondary payloads, actually, Swiftwing Corellas.
Denton, what rocket is IMAP riding to space in?
IMAP, actually, as a matter of fact, all three of our missions this year will be flying on a Falcon 9 with a previously flown booster, and the Falcon 9 will take all three of I should say all three, because Sphere-X, we have a primary with four secondaries, and then on IMAP, we have a primary with one secondary, and Sentinel-6 will be flying by itself. So Falcon 9 rockets, it's with their reusable first stage, we'll be flying previously flown first stages on all of those with a new second stage. And of course, at this point, we'll put the payload fairing to protect us as we fly through the atmosphere. So those are the launch vehicles we'll be using for these three missions this year.
And as you mentioned, space weather affects so many things down here on Earth, like our power grids, our communication systems as well. But I'm also assuming it informs how you go about doing your job as well in launching payloads, right? So this satellite that you are helping launch is going to help launch future satellites by providing detailed space weather for future launches, right?
Yes, absolutely. Because space weather is a big thing that we have to monitor when we're getting ready to launch. Because if there's a major solar event going on and there's a significant radiation just outside the atmosphere, we may decide to launch on another day to avoid that, because it really impacts a lot of satellites. So yeah, that's absolutely something that is very important for us and future launches.
Well, hopefully the space weather is good for that launch, and we can see it launching from Cape Canaveral. and the regular weather too, right? The earthly weather is also very important. Speaking of terrestrial weather, another payload that you're responsible for launching this year, Sentinel-6B. Tell us about this one.
Oh, Sentinel-6B. So actually this one is a second of that, and I mean, technically it's been a series of Sentinel-6 ones. And we do have some counterparts, our European counterparts, who's helped us out with this mission. And this is another series of Earth observing satellites that will help us kind of understand the Earth's atmosphere and the Earth's terrestrial weather as well. So, and that's another big one, because there's been a series of that. We launched Sentinel 6MF a couple years ago, and this will be another one. It's actually identical to that one. So this will kind of be a sister satellite to that one, but it will also help us better understand the Earth terrestrial weather.
All three of them are flying on reusable boosters. I know part of your job is assessing the risks that go into a space flight for a particular payload on a particular rocket. Is having a reused booster, does that give you greater peace of mind, or is there more concern that it's been flown before?
One of the things we did as a program is we looked diligently at the Falcon 9 as well as the previously flown booster. So our team has worked rigorously with SpaceX to ensure that whether it's a first flight or one that's previously flown, it's still safe and does not increase risk to our NASA spacecraft. So our team has worked through that, and we are comfortable with a new booster as well as a previously flown booster. And like I said, we've done a lot of work to understand it and understand where the risk is and buy down as much risk as possible for our mission.
Finally, Denton, I want to talk, you know, your job is finding rides to orbit and beyond for these scientific and technical payloads on rockets. It seems we're getting more and more rockets coming online and available to NASA. Does this make it easier for you to have a bunch of different rides to space, or is it an abundance of riches and it's very difficult to pick what rocket is going to be getting what payload?
I would say we always want different rockets out there, because one, it's nice to have some competition, and two, it provides different capabilities. And that's always nice, because we have such a wide range of spacecraft that we try to get launched. And it's nice to have a variety of rockets with different capabilities and sizes, et cetera. So it allows us to not only that, kind of we also helps us to promote the U.S. commercial space industry as well by having it. And competition is always good for taxpayers. It allows us better, cheaper rides. So that's always a good thing for taxpayers. And we always work diligently to help our commercial industry, to help foster that commercial industry. When we have more rockets, we have more capability out there. It could get challenging at times, but for the most part, we look, that is what we want, and that's what we try to foster, and that's what we look forward to, is having an abundance of riches when it comes to different commercial launch vehicles.
Well, you keep putting stuff in space, because we need stuff to talk about on this show. So I appreciate the work you do. We've been speaking with Denton Gibson. He's launch director in NASA's Launch Services Program at the agency's Kennedy Space Center here in Florida. Denton, thank you so much for joining us.
No problem. Happy to be here.
That's going to do it for this week's show. If you're not already, be sure to subscribe to the show's podcast feed so you never miss an episode. Do that on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, the NPR app, YouTube, really wherever you get your podcasts. You can stay connected with the show. Follow us on social media. Our handle is AWTYSpace. Are we there yet, Space? Get it. Or on Instagram and Facebook for right now. And if you've got an idea for a future episode of the show, or you want to join us as a guest, well, we're here to listen. Email us, arewethereyet@cfpublic.org. More space coverage is on our website, cfpublic.org/space. Are We There Yet is a production of Central Florida Public Media. Our producer is Marion Summerall. Our intern is Allison Castillo. Editorial guidance from LaToya Dennis. Support for Are We There Yet comes from our listeners. Until next week, I'm Brendan Byrne. Thanks for listening.